from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Diane Ravitch studies and cares about the education of America's kids. Years back, she fought hard for reforms like charter schools and No Child Left Behind. But then, Ravitch had a change of heart. Now, she says, America's school reform movement is a hoax, a Trojan horse dragged into public education to gut it and turn it into for-profit private enterprise. Really? This hour on Point, education historian Diane Ravitch on the future of America's public schools. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. How are you looking at school reform these days? The education of America's children, our public schools. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Diane Ravitch. She was U.S. Assistant Secretary of Education in the administration of President George H.W. Bush, later served on the National Assessment Governing Board in the Clinton administration, celebrated the passage of No Child Left Behind in 2005. Now she's at New York University, and her new book is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Diane Ravitch, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for having me on.
I've read a lot of this, and it's you write very compellingly. But the first thing I stumbled on, Diane, was you say this is the whole – we'll talk about it. We'll go right through your argument. But you say that the reform movement has turned into a kind of a privatization movement to take over, but isn't it a tiny portion of charter schools that are actually for-profit?
Well, I think there are a significant number of schools that are for profit. In the state of Michigan, for example, more than 80% of the schools are for profit. In the state of Ohio, the two biggest charter operators in the state of Ohio have collected over $1 billion in public funds to run some of the state's worst charter schools, and they never get closed because these guys happen to be major campaign contributors to the party that's in power.
But nationally, I know we can cite these, and we'll look at them. But nationally, I'm reading here, the National School Boards Association saying for-profit organizations today run about 12% of all charter schools. Is that too much private school in America for you?
But a lot of the charters that are nonprofit then turn their operations over to for-profit companies. There are states that have laws saying they will not permit for-profit corporations to own charters, but the nonprofit board is a shell board for a for-profit company. I think that what is more concerning to me, and let me step back by saying that there are good charter schools. I say this in the book. I say it in all of my public speeches. There are good charter schools. There are absolutely terrible charter schools. But on average, charter schools, if they have the same kids, do not get different results from public schools. So what we're doing, or what our nation is doing under this false narrative of reform, is privatizing our schools by handing the public money over to private entrepreneurs. There's a charter chain, for example, that I talk about in the book that's being started by Andre Agassi. He raised $750 million in venture capital to start charter schools. Now,
for
Andre
a tennis
Agassi
school
is,
or a tennis?
No, they're not tennis schools. He should be running tennis camps. He will be running charter schools across the country for which he has no qualification. And I can point to charter schools in state after state where there is no public accountability, no transparency, where there's self-dealing on the board, whether it's for-profit or nonprofit. The entire board in some states, like in Arizona, where conflict of interest it does not apply to charter schools, the entire board is made up of family members, and they pay each other to do services for the schools.
So we're going to talk with a supporter of charter schools in this hour, Diane, but what's the big thing you say is going on here? I mean, I know there are some people who would like to get rid of public schools. Ron Paul has a new book out, The School Revolution, and basically the message there is abolish public schools. I mean, more than basically, explicitly. But I think most of us look at that and say, well, there's always been proponents of private education as in addition to public, and surely public will always be the mainstay of American education.
Well, there is a movement afoot, and it's in many states. It's in Tennessee. It's in North Carolina. It's in Georgia. It's across the South. It's in Ohio. It's in Pennsylvania. I can name state after state where there is a very strong push for vouchers, for taking public money out of the public schools and giving it over to private hands. And there's no evidence that it provides better education. And charters, I think many charters were started by very idealistic and well-meaning people. But the movement itself is now heavily supported by the Koch brothers, by the Walton Family Foundation, which puts all of its money into privatization, and by many other groups on the far right, like ALEC. ALEC is a major actor in terms of pushing charter legislation.
ALEC, the state-level group around legislation.
ALEC is an organization that is very powerful. It gets involved in many issues. Education is only one of them. It's funded by major corporations. It's the American Legislative Exchange Council. It's a far-right organization that wants deregulation, wants the government out of everything. And they fight for vouchers, for charters, for removing anything that protects job security from teachers. They're opposed to collective bargaining.
How do you read their base of all these, this particular strain of supporters of charters, and how do you read their basic motivation? Maybe it's just get American kids a good education.
Well, I think there's a mix. There are people who have been taken in by the dominant narrative, and I want to talk about the dominant narrative because that is the message of my book. We have been subject to a PR narrative that is manufactured. It's a manufactured crisis, and I'm borrowing that term from a book of many years ago by David Berliner and Bruce Biddle. The manufactured crisis is that our schools are failing and they're declining. And what I show very factually in the early chapters of the book is all of this is not true. High school, the graduation rates today have never been higher in American history. The dropout rates have never been lower than they are today. Test scores have never been higher than they are today for white students, black students, Hispanic students, and Asian students. So all the talk of we're declining, we're failing, all of this is simply not true.
But yet these lists are laid down in front of us, Diane, of international rankings, and there's the U.S. down at, you know, I don't know, 18 or 25 or 27, depending on the list, or, you know, and people say, look, there's the proof. We got a
crisis. That is not, in fact, proof, because I have a chapter on international test scores, and the first thing you need to know about them is that our country has never done well on them, and it doesn't make any difference.
Why?
The first international test was given in 1964, and we came in last. In the 50 years that followed, we surpassed all of the other 11 nations in economic productivity, technological innovation, democratic institutions, creativity, name the measure, and we surpassed all the others because the scores don't predict anything. As it happens, the most recent international test that was given is not the one that you hear frequently quoted by the reformers, but it was one called TIMSS. That's the most recent test. It's the Trends in International Math and Science Survey. Mm-hmm. Our kids tied Finland. Our kids tied the top performing nations all across Europe, and the only nations that outperformed us were the very test-based cultures of places like Singapore, Hong Kong, Japan. But our kids did incredibly well. Black students in Massachusetts tied the students of Finland in fourth and eighth grade mathematics. How amazing is that?
I noticed that nationally, when you cited groups earlier, I think you said white kids, Chinese kids, I forget what else, but I didn't hear you say black and Latino. What's the deal?
Oh, I did. The high school graduation rates and the test scores of black students and Hispanic students, white students and Asian students are at a historic high point. All groups, not just whites and Asians, black students and Hispanic students at a historic high, and the dropout rates for these groups are at a historic low.
I'm not sure I get what you're saying, because you cite problems in American education in your book. So you're saying
there are
problems but no crisis? What make the distinction?
There is a huge distinction. Our American public education system is a great public education system. The crisis that we're now in are the attacks on and the manufactured crisis and the lies that are being told about the system as a whole. The true crisis is the combination, I call it the toxic combination, of poverty and segregation. And in any school district where kids are overwhelmingly poor, Philadelphia and Detroit being good examples of that, desperate poverty amongst the children and the families, and highly segregated, the test scores are terrible, the graduation rates are terrible, and it's not caused by the schools. The first day that the kids arrive in kindergarten, they're already behind. There's an achievement gap that begins before they come to school, and the kids are, many of them are homeless, many of them have never seen a doctor. There are terrible social problems, and our society is not addressing them.
Of course, some reformers have said, look, the way to address these problems is to use the schools as the crowbar, the leverage. Get in there, give them an education, do whatever it takes, get those scores up, get them well-educated, and then one by one, they will help these communities climb out of poverty and segregation.
First of all, schools can't do it alone. Schools need the support of the community, meaning that we should have prenatal care for every poor woman who cannot afford prenatal care. We are something like 130th in the world, according to the March of Dimes in the United Nations, in providing prenatal care. And when women don't have good prenatal care, they end up having children with developmental deficiencies. That means huge cost in special education into the future. We should have early childhood education that is universal. We rank way behind all the nations of Europe. The Economist magazine did a survey last year. We were 24th among the advanced nations of Europe and North America, 24th in providing high-quality universal pre-K. That would help to narrow the gap before the children arrive in school. There should be a health clinic attached to every school. One of the reasons that poor kids do badly in school and get low test scores is because they're absent so much more frequently because of ill health, because of asthma, because they have many of them can't see the blackboard. They've never seen an eye doctor. They've never had their ears checked for their hearing. They do not have access to the same quality of medical care, and there should be in every school a school nurse to refer them to a place where they can get the medical attention they need.
Are you just absolving schools of responsibility?
Absolutely not. I think that schools should need a very, and this is really crucial, schools need great professionals. They need to have highly qualified teachers who have had at least a year of preparation before they become teachers. They need to have principals who are master teachers themselves. They need to have superintendents who are educators, not businessmen and lawyers and admirals
Diane,
and generals.
Hold the thought. We have to take a short break. The new book is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the way we look at our schools, what's right, what's wrong, where the problems really are. Diane Ravitch is with us. She was at one time a big supporter of school reform, more or less the whole package, charter schools, testing, accountability, and the rest. She's turned around in a big way in recent years, and she's writing about it in her new book, The Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. She joins us today from New York. Certainly, lots of charter schools have grown up in the years since Diane Ravitch was a supporter. Today, 90% of public schools in New Orleans are charter schools. Just last month, parents, students, teachers, the mayor, state rep, gathered in the spanking new library of the Young Audiences Charter School in Jefferson Parish to celebrate. School leader Fowell Dunbar shouted out the school's mission and called on a young student to do the honors and cut the ribbon.
Our mission is that every one of our creative learners meet their academic and artistic goals, which means they get into the high school of their choice, they get into the college of their choice, they get the most out of life because of the experiences they have here. Sincere is going to do the honors and cut the ribbon. Everybody, with your cameras ready? All right, Sincere, it's up to you. One, two, three.
Cutting the ribbon in New Orleans, where 90% of schools are now charter schools. Diane Ravitch, high school of their choice, college of their choice, the most out of life. What's not to like?
Well, what's not to like about New Orleans is it's called the Recovery School District. It is the lowest ranking school district in the state of Louisiana. So it's certainly made progress. The scores have gone up year after year. It is still the lowest ranking school district in the state of Louisiana. And by everyone's measure down there, at least 2/3 of the charter schools have been rated by the state failing schools. Other independent researchers say it's 80% of the charter schools are failing schools. So, you know, you can get a pep rally in any kind of a school, but charterizing the schools of America is a terrible idea. It means that we change our focus away from the public responsibility, the civic responsibility to support public education, and turn education into a consumer good. Like you decide, oh, I'm going to go buy my shoes at this store and not that store. I'll buy a car here and not there. Then people say, well, why should I support public education? It's not my responsibility. Go out and take care of your own children. And my argument is that everybody, whether you send your child to private school, parochial school, or even childless, you have a responsibility for public education, because public education is akin to the services of the police department, the fire department, public beaches, public roads, and the monitoring of air and water. These are public responsibilities, providing a free public education system of the highest quality and making it better for the kids in the inner city. I was just in Philadelphia last night and the night before that in Pittsburgh. There are 19 librarians in the city of Philadelphia for over 200 schools. No suburb would stand for that in its schools. They have cut the guidance counselors. They've cut the social workers. This is a city where 40% of the kids are poor, and they are getting a quality of educational services that suburban parents would rebel about. Testing is not helping them.
You go all the way back almost to the founding of the Republic. You quote John Adams in the front piece of the book saying, "The whole people must take upon themselves the education of the whole people and be willing to bear the expenses of it." Goes on to say, you know, not founded by a charitable individual, but maintained at the public expense of the people themselves. But to help us here, because Americans care about education, and I think a lot of them have, you know, step by step, bought into a lot of the critique that's been raised, and you helped raise it back in the day. So help us understand your thinking. Listeners could be excused for feeling whiplash here. Here's one writing on our website, Diane. She says, "So if you got it wrong the first time and released a mountain of changes that you regret, why should we believe you this time, your analysis this time? What was your evolution?"
I'm a historian. I've been writing about American education for 40 years. My first book was A History of the Public Schools. And in the early 90s, I was very dissatisfied with the quality of education. I thought that our standards should be much higher. Mm-hmm. I believe in it. I've always believed in the same thing. I've always believed that every child should have a rich curriculum in history and civics and the arts. I think the arts are crucial in foreign languages and science and math and all of that. And I felt that we were not doing as much as we could to provide kids that rich knowledge base.
So you got on the bandwagon for accountability.
But the reason I got on the bandwagon was because I believed that testing and competition and choice would lead to better schools because they would get better by competing. Yeah. That's an old-fashioned American belief. Mm-hmm. The reason I changed my views, and that came about around 2006, 2007, was that I saw the numbers. I saw that what was happening with No Child Left Behind was that we were spending more and more money on testing. The curriculum that I want for all kids was being narrowed only to reading and math because that's all that counted, and that there were actually no gains from it. I began looking at the research into things like merit pay and discovered that over 100 years, merit pay has come and gone, and it has never, ever improved test scores. It doesn't lead to better education. All the things that I thought might work didn't work, and so I began rethinking. I mean, I know that it's unheard of in American culture today to say I was wrong, and I wrote a book 3 years ago, which became a bestseller, The Death and Life of the American School System, in which I said, I was wrong. I need to set the record straight. I was wrong. All of the things we're doing now don't work. And let me just give you something that I think is crucial. We test every child every year between third grade and eighth grade. We're now testing kids. We're now giving standardized tests to kids in kindergarten, in first grade, and second grade. There is no other country in the world that does this. In every other country, they test kids two or three times in the course of their entire school career. We are wasting billions of dollars on testing, billions that could be used to reduce class size. The kids that I saw in Philadelphia, and whether they're in Detroit or in Houston or any big city, they need smaller classes, and instead they're getting larger and larger classes. Many of these kids don't speak or read English. Many of these children have disabilities, far more in the inner city because of poverty than in the suburbs. And they're the kids who are getting shafted because they have so many of the resources are going into totally useless things like testing. Testing kids more doesn't make them learn more. They learn more because they're in smaller classes. They have well-prepared teachers who've had, as I said, at least a year of teacher preparation and a good education, and they need an experienced school staff. There is such a thing as a good school where the climate and the culture is one of stability, where people are good educators, they care about the kids, they stay, they don't come and go every 2 years. And that's what inner-city kids need.
I've got a lot of questions here. I can imagine listeners' heads spinning because, I mean, this sounds like before all of the reform talk that we've heard in recent years. We've got a lot of callers for you. We're going to hear in a moment from a supporter of charter schools and that push. Jessica Levin will join us. Let's go to St. Louis for a caller. Corey, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Diane Ravitch.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. To give you a little bit of a history, and I'm pretty sure your guest knows, in St. Louis, we have at least 5 school districts that lost their accreditation over the past few years, and St. Louis City is one of them. And the school district in which my 5-year-old started kindergarten this year was the Normandy district. Now, we have all these districts that have lost their accreditation just in the St. Louis area alone. The school board is still intact. The same people are still there. The educators are still there. And we're still pumping millions of dollars into these districts that still cannot get the accreditation that they need. And yet, and still, I have to, as a blue-collar worker, send my daughter to another district 10 miles further than what the district that she was supposed to be in.
Corey, I hear the frustration. What would you like to see as a citizen there?
He'd like to see a good neighborhood public school.
Let him speak for himself for a second. Corey?
I would like to see some type of accountability to work when there's a district that's not performing, that there's immediate results. And I think that the charter schools can do this since this is a private matter to where they're going to look at profitability. But the things about these school boards and districts is they spend more on the legal fees in trying to defend their job instead of trying to do what it needs to do to, you know, correct the core curriculum of the problem.
Yeah. Corey, stand by. Diane, you say he wants good public schools. Maybe he would, but his answer is he wants accountability and maybe charter schools.
I would say that St. Louis is a victim of reform, and I don't call it reform. I call it corporate reform. St. Louis has been through private management. St. Louis has had many charter schools. St. Louis just kicked out a whole bunch of charter schools run by the Imagine Corporation, a for-profit corporation, because they were among the lowest performing in the state. They've gone and set up shop somewhere else. What we have today in American education is a tsunami of bad ideas that are destroying the most important thing, and that's what he needs for his children, and that is a good neighborhood school where he doesn't have to pay for it and where the staff doesn't turn over every year and where money is wasted on legal fees and where money is wasted on consultants.
But
who
what
bring
about
in their
his frustration?
Programs.
Very real. They're not accredited because they're not producing. And he doesn't.
His
stability doesn't sound like his first concern. He wants change. He wants better education.
He should want better education. He should want a good neighborhood school that we most of us grew up with, where there was a curriculum with teachers who knew how to teach reading and math and science and history and foreign languages.
Diane,
and
with
where
respect,
there was a vibrant
sounds like
program
you're
in the
ducking.
Arts.
It sounds
no,
like
no,
I'm
not ducking.
You, it
I'm not ducking.
Like
I know a lot about the St. Louis system. The St. Louis system has
but how
been
is he supposed to get that? It's one thing to describe some misty former time and say we'd like that.
I'm not
but
describing
he wants
a misty
now.
Time. I'm telling you that St. Louis is a victim of reform. They have been through private management. They have been through corporate management. They have had mayoral control. They have had every conceivable turnover over the past 10 years. They have desperate poverty, and they're doing nothing to bring any realistic change to the school district.
So how do you brace up a public school district that's in trouble, that's losing accreditation, and, you know, get performance, get education for Corey's children that's not miles and miles away from home?
It's not going to be charter schools, because the charter schools, when they take the same kids, now maybe what he'll do is he'll find a charter school that only accepts kids with high scores. Then he'll get a better quality of education. Keep the poor kids out, resegregate them, keep them locked in ghettos where they won't be near his kids, and then we will create in this country a dual school system such as we had before Brown versus Board of Education, where the poor kids and the kids who don't make it and the cut-ups are segregated, where the kids with disabilities are kept out of the school, where the kids who are English language learners are kept out of the school. That works. But it's wrong.
Corey, good luck. Cindy in Nashville, Tennessee. Cindy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Ms. Ravitch, I could not agree with you more. I live in Tennessee. Our education commissioner is Kevin Huffman. I think you're familiar with him.
I am indeed.
There was something that was supposed to be hosted by Senator Alexander that was nothing more than a sales meeting for charter schools. And unfortunately, Mr. Huffman was there and said, and this is a quote, "The more we let the marketplace drive where resources go, the more likely we are to have better schools develop." And I was horrified, because essentially he laid out what is he and his and our governor, who also has a corporate background, their philosophy for public education, which is to privatize it. And, you know, right now in Tennessee, there's a letter that's being drafted from several superintendents of schools all over the state basically telling the governor that they do not agree with Mr. Huffman and do not like the direction.
Cindy, why is it horrifying to you? Just lay it out for us. Why is the privatization horrifying, you say?
Because once we make, once we make school children equivalent to a money opportunity, an opportunity for someone to make money, it takes all opportunity for, just as Ms. Ravitch is saying, for people to move out of poverty, to move up. Once we take all the altruism out of the system, once it's just about making money, you no longer have public education. You have a school corporation, a corporation of schools, and that seems to be what our governor wishes to change the Tennessee school system into.
Cindy, we've got that report, and I appreciate you make it very clearly. I want to get one more call. I'll take it all to Diane. Cynthia in Bethel, Connecticut. Cynthia, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I am a former Board of Education member in my town. I'm also a taxpayer advocate, and I can tell you, if you think that government-funded, locally-funded schools are not, that some people are not benefiting from that, I think you're mistaken.
I don't know what you're saying, Cynthia. What's your point?
I think that my experience with the Board of Education and in my town, it's the most insular group I've ever seen. It's very slanted. We had a superintendent for 12 years who was very ambitious.
So is it too privatized? Is it too teacher-oriented?
No, I am for privatizing. I'm talking about this because we have public schools and they're funded.
Why are you for it? Why?
Why am I for privatization?
Yeah.
Because I feel that there's more choice involved. I think that the argument against privatization because of money-making opportunities or because it's privately funded is not representing what public education is, because public education is not an altruistic exercise.
What is it?
It's very politically motivated.
What do you mean? Why not take your experienced staff, as Diane says, go for stability and just dig in and educate your kids?
Well, I feel that I would rather have a choice to put my child in an environment that I have more control over, that I can participate more in, and that, to me, would be a private school.
Why can't you participate, in an ordinary school? You're on the school board, for heaven's sake. That's participation. PTA, PTO.
I was in a minority party of the school board, and I can tell you it's not what it's painted to be.
Diane says stop beating up teachers and instead support them. What do you say, Cynthia?
I support the teachers. I do not support collective bargaining. We were hobbled by the unions. It was a foregone conclusion that we had to acquiesce to what the unions requested because that was the union. And then we were facilitating the payments of the dues, the union dues, to the union, which is a political lobby.
Cynthia, we've got it. Diane, there's two very different takes. In Connecticut, Cynthia says, please give me the option. In Tennessee, Cindy says, the marketplace is eating me alive here.
Well, I happen to know both states very well. I've spent the last 3 years traveling the country, meeting with teachers, school board members, superintendents, ordinary folks. The first thing you need to know about Connecticut, it's one of the three highest performing states in the nation on the federally funded test called NAEP. Connecticut schools are simply outstanding. In fact, if you looked at the three highest performing states, they're Connecticut, Massachusetts number one, Connecticut, New Jersey vying for two and three. They all have unions, so the unions don't drag down their performance. I happen to know the state of Tennessee extremely well. I follow the politics there. There is a push there to privatize all the schools. When you privatize, you introduce segregation, social stratification. The rich kids go to this school, the poor kids go to that school,
Diane,
and the government
right
thinks
there.
It's fine.
Diane Ravitch's new book is Reign of Error. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the way we look at our schools. What's right, what's wrong, where the problems really are. Diane Ravitch is here. She used to support hard-nosed school reform. She's had a change of heart of thinking. Her new book is Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. Joins us from New York. Jessica Levin joins us now as well from New York, education policy advisor in the Department of Education under Bill Clinton, now an independent education consultant. Research looks at progress in the reform movement, consultant and former chief knowledge officer for the New Teacher Project. Michelle Rhee had a lot of involvement with that. Jessica Levin in New York, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
So you see this big critique, Diane. I mean, the bottom line is her assertion is that the reform movement has one way and another turned into a privatization movement that's more concerned with corporatizing than with education. What do you say?
Okay. Well, I, too, earlier in the year, long before I read Ravitch's book, I was concerned about the deteriorating image of reformers and reform and also possible missteps reformers may have made. So I actually interviewed over 50 education leaders, state and district superintendents, mm-hmm. policymaker, charter leaders, academics, parent organizers. And I can just attest that none of them sounded remotely like the corporate education reformer that Ravitch characterizes. And I just want to take an example. The premise of her book is the hoax of privatization, mm-hmm. that everybody, all this whole generation of education leaders are bent on overtesting our children and privatizing our schools and creating mass markets around vouchers and for-profit schools. And the reality is the vast majority of those I interviewed actually don't even have a lot of faith in markets to systemically.
Well, how do you explain that? I mean, here's Ron Paul with his new book, Abolish yep. Public Schools. He yep. says, here's, we just heard from our caller in Tennessee, and yep. you must know it as well. There's the head of schools and the governor talking marketplace, yep. marketplace. That's privatization. I mean, yep.
and
that's
I think
not image. That's reality.
There are some people who are strong advocates for for-profit schools and privatization, but the vast majority of what I call this current generation of education leader is not at all compelled by that. In fact, many of them told me that they view vouchers and for-profits far more as distractions than game changers. And in fact, you take any of the claims that Ravitch makes about this group, and none of them actually hold up. Take testing, for example. The book tries to claim that this generation is only about testing children and that only test scores matter.
Well, we know there's a huge emphasis on that. Anybody who's got a kid in school knows that.
And in fact, interestingly, the vast majority I spoke to, they mm. believe, like the public, mm. that testing should have some role in identifying student achievement and some role in evaluating teachers. But they, too, are actually concerned about the risk of overtesting and the current perverse focus on tests. And in fact, you take any issue, Ravitch's book creates these false dichotomies. Either you believe schools are the problem or poverty is the problem. Either you're all for charter schools regardless of the quality mm. or you're against charter mm-hmm. schools. But actually, the vast majority of those working on school reform now really are rejecting those false dichotomies.
I will take that
and
to
are
Diane.
Grappling yeah. with the
nuances
complex
in the
problems in the middle.
I want to go to the
issues.
Middle, but let me ask you: Do you think, Jessica Levin, it matters mm-hmm. if American American education is predominantly public or private? Does it matter to you?
Well, I just want to clarify something that is really obscured in this book. Is that, for example, Ravitch tries to suggest that nonprofit charter schools that are open enrollment and make no money and are accountable to those who authorize them are in some way private schools. And in fact, there's nothing private about these schools. As I said, they're open to the public and they're open enrollment and they're accountable to authorizing bodies.
Jessica, I want to come back to the question. Mm-hmm. I put a very direct question to you and you did not answer mm-hmm. it.
Yeah.
But I would like you to answer it. Does it matter to you if American kids are educated in public schools or private schools? Does it matter
If you mean like charter schools that I believe are public schools?
No, I mean private schools.
You mean like selective private schools
for profit? I mean, I don't want to get caught up.
I do not support that. I don't think anyone does. But if you
support
look at the vast
support,
majority,
you do not support what?
I think there needs to be a vibrant public school system, and I think charter schools can create that vibrant public school system. But I don't think any reformer is assuming that charter schools are going to be that entire system. I think what we are saying is let's look at what the best charter schools are doing, the best charter schools that are actually taking students, the same students as all other schools, and that they're nonprofit. And let's look at those who are doing so much more for high-poverty kids, who are getting more of those kids through college than even our middle-class schools, who are making a dramatic difference. And let's learn from those schools,
Diane Ravitch,
about what other schools may be able to do that can raise the achievement and the success of those students.
Yep. Diane, Jessica says you're setting up straw men. Let's use both. Let's go to the middle or use the best of each.
Okay. Let me say, because she made a number of charges that are simply not true. My book does not say it's only poverty. It does not set up a dichotomy between schools or blameless and poverty is everything.
But it does say at bottom it's poverty. That is your message, as I read
the
your book.
The single most reliable predictor of low test scores is poverty, and that is indisputable. Whether you look at international tests, the NAEP federal test, state test, the ACT, the SAT, if you want to predict test scores, simply look at what the income of the parents is. That is the single most reliable predictor. Mm-hmm. So long as these so-called reformers, and I will not call them reformers, I call them corporate reformers, so long as the corporate reformers insist that the schools can one by one solve the problems of poverty at a time when we have the greatest income inequality ever recorded in the history of the United States, where we have 10% of the population consuming more than 50% of the income, where the only people benefiting from the boom of the past few years has been the top 1%. And then we're going to say, let's disregard poverty and let the schools fix the problem. I say that's nonsense.
But Jessica says it's not profit driving here.
There is profit involved. If you look at what's happening in North Carolina, you don't think that there's profit involved there in the voucher movement. We now have 17 states with vouchers. We now have 17 states where not a single voter has voted to approve vouchers. We have three cities with vouchers where there is money going to religious schools, public money, and where the kids do no better and often very much worse than they were in their so-called failing school. But I want to say go to a couple of her points. Mm-hmm. And she said, gee, everybody's against testing. Well, guess what? It's not only is it federal law, the No Child Left Behind law, which was based on a hoax to begin with, the hoax of the Texas miracle. We then got race to the top, which didn't say we're going to provide equality of educational opportunity. It said we're going to race to some mythical top of test scores. We're going to evaluate teachers by test scores. We're going to close schools by test scores. All this push for testing, it's not coming from the American public. It's coming from policymakers. And I predict you're going to see this coming spring a massive opt-out movement because now the suburban parents realize this is wrong. Texas rolled back its testing laws. Texas, where all this nonsense started, rolled back.
So what about a middle ground? Jessica says, one second.
Tom?
Yes?
I agree. Actually, one of the concerns that motivated my interviewing education leaders in the first place was I was concerned about some of the testing policies.
Yep.
I was concerned about some of the state legislation that was being passed that I felt was excessively top-down and prescriptive. I think the thing that most disappoints me about this book is that in its level of caricature and the fact that it reduces very complex issues down to in a very reductionist way, to me, it moves the debate in the wrong direction, even a more toxic, polarized direction, as opposed to helping us solve the problems, the very complex problems that we're all trying to solve.
Well, I mean, that can cut both ways. Sometimes you have to cut through complexity to see what's really going on. Other times, I quite agree. If you leave the complexity aside, you may lose opportunities. Diane, what about the middle ground? What about some both and here?
I have both and throughout the book. I think what's happened is because I have 40 pages or 40 graphs taken from the U.S. Department of Education website to support what I'm saying, that test scores have never been higher for white kids, black kids, Hispanic kids, and Asian kids. The dropout rates have never been lower, and that the high school graduation rates have never been higher. All this is fact. This is not a caricature. And so the people who don't want to hear the truth say that they don't like the messenger, so they want to shoot the messenger. They say, oh, it's a caricature. I'm now hearing this on all the corporate reform sites. It's a caricature. She's being shrill. Well, my dear, I've been in this studying education for 40 years. I don't make a single statement without documentation behind it. I have footnotes for everything I've said. I have traveled this country. I've seen what's happening in Tennessee. I've seen what's happening in North Carolina, where a teacher must work for 15 years before reaching a salary of $40,000. Teachers are being demonized across this country. Teachers have never been more demoralized than they are today. You cannot build a strong teaching profession when the MetLife survey says that teachers are so demoralized that a third of them are prepared to quit. We are destroying our education system in the name of charters, which, by the way, you say are public schools. The reason I say they're not public schools is that there have been court cases in federal court where the charter corporations were asked, why will you not obey the state labor law? And they came in and said, we're not public schools. We are a private corporation. There were hearings before the National Labor Relations Board where the charter corporation said, we are a private corporation. If they continue to say we can evade the state and federal laws because we're a private corporation, we are not public, then I agree with them.
Katie in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Katie, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Hi. So I'd like to ask Diane, the testing metrics that she disagrees with, she uses to cite the success of certain states like Massachusetts and Connecticut, whose in the last 20 years have seen an explosion of charter schools. And then she also cites the Department of Education saying that dropout rates are the lowest, achievement is growing.
Yep. Yep.
Don't you think that may be attributable to growth in charter schools, which are publicly funded and accountable to the state? And the cases that she cites, not every single charter management organization is a for-profit organization. The vast majority of them are not-for-profit. So, you know, I agree with Jessica in the sense that, you know, these dichotomies are ridiculous.
Katie, let us pick it up. Diane, what about it? If the numbers are good, maybe charter schools deserve some credit for those.
Well, actually not, because the studies, the overwhelming majority of studies show that charters don't get different results from public schools. And the Massachusetts improvement had nothing to do with charters, because at the time the 1993 law was passed in Massachusetts, called the Education Reform Act, it permitted the creation of 25 charter schools for the entire state of Massachusetts. So no one can say that the entire state of Massachusetts was lifted up by the creation of 25 charter schools. That's simply ridiculous. And we have lots of states with many, many charter schools that do not have high performance, Texas being one of them. And charter schools are spreading wherever the right wing takes charge, because the right wing wants to destroy public education.
Let me go to Ferry in Des Moines, Iowa, if I may. Our time is short. Ferry, you're on the air.
Thank you. I live in Des Moines. However, I am a retired Milwaukee public school teacher.
Okay.
I felt as a teacher I was on the front line of poverty. Being that teacher, I can only tell you we had plenty of charter and choice schools. And what my experience was that they did the testing. They said, nope, they were not testing any better than MPS schools. They lured parents to their schools, and I know this because I've talked with parents when I taught, say, in 2004,
yep.
Really became apparent. They said, oh, well, there's only going to be 10 in the class. Okay, so they were lured by that. They were also lured recently, and I think it's the Andre Agassi. We have one of those in Milwaukee, but they would lure them also by saying, we'll pay for your supplies. What's happening is they are luring the children to their schools, but they are not qualified teachers, nor are they teaching what is expected. Are they teaching to the core standards? No. Do they have qualified teachers in there? No. Do they even have to take the test? Granted, I do believe, I agree, there are way too many tests that are being given to our children, and that money could be spent on counteracting some of the effect of poverty.
Ferry, we've got it. I appreciate your call from Des Moines there on Milwaukee. Jessica, what's your vision then? If you say this is a character, you say it's a caricature. What's your actual vision?
Well, so my goal, and I actually, as Diane also says, I actually think buried in her book are some indications that she's actually more conciliatory than you might even think. Because, for example, some places she acknowledges that the union reform priorities of many of these generation of education leaders, she actually agrees with them that principals in general, let's forget about charter schools, just overall school districts principals should have more say over who comes to their schools because teachers are so different. They should have more control over who they hire as well as who they need to fire in case of poor performance. So I actually think Ravitch may be willing to join me in my effort to build a new coalition of leaders who are willing to do what is the difficult, very dispiriting but necessary work of figuring out what this messy middle looks like.
Diane, you willing to get in that harness together or not, Diane Ravitch?
I think there's lots of room within my vision, which is laid out in the book, about a middle ground, about the things that we can agree on which are important. And I think first is to agree that schools can't do it alone. And I'm glad your last caller was talking about Milwaukee, because here's a perfect case of a system that decided in 1990, 23 years ago, to have vouchers. They now have a vibrant voucher sector, a charter sector, and a diminishing public sector. Everybody is a consumer. Everybody chooses. They finally started testing in 2012, the state test. All three sectors got the same results. On the federal test, which is the only one that I put any credence in because there are no stakes attached to it, Milwaukee is one of the lowest performing systems in the entire country, with vouchers, charters, and publics all doing poorly, and one of the poorest systems in the country, one of the poorest cities in terms of the kids. And the public schools are overloaded with the special ed kids because the charters and the vouchers don't want them.
I think you both lead us to look past the bumper stickers, think more deeply here. Diane, you must raise people's antenna on this front. What does it mean if there's a kind of de facto privatization? And Jessica, your call to look for the best of each, I'm sure people will be paying attention to, but there may be some fundamental choices here. This has been really eye-opening. I'm grateful to both of you. Jessica Levin in New York, thank you for joining us today, Jessica.
Thank you, Tom.
And Diane Ravitch, author of Reign of Error. Thank you, Diane.
Thank you, Tom. It introduced yesterday, and it's within the top.
This is On Point.